It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wakebright.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around.
This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
When you get laws through, the corporate lobbyists try to undermine them, weaken them, strip them of adequate budgets, put people in charge who come from their own industry.
Then there are people who call me with consistent problems where the vehicle hesitates and stops in the middle of the road. Now, I don't think that last one would require an expert to prove that the vehicle is significantly impaired.
Consumer activist Ralph Nader, famed author of Unsafe at Any Speed, is interviewed, along with private attorney John Gale at the Consumer Law Group, who informs us about Virginia's motor vehicle lemon law and carries on the vital advocacy against defective products and for safer cars. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. This show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around.
And now, this week's news you can use. In July, the Virginia State Corporation Commission entered into a settlement agreement for $38,000 with payday lender Allied Cash Advance for violating multiple sections of the state's Payday Loan Act. The settlement is the second large case the state regulator has pursued against a payday lender this year. The first settlement for $100,000 in February involved Check and Go. Each violation of the state's payday loan law can bring a $1,000 fine. The state said Allied violated six sections of the law, but did not specify the number of violations. Allied was sued last year in Virginia by a borrower who taped a phone call of an Allied employee pretending to be with law enforcement and threatening arrest for an overdue loan, both of which are illegal in Virginia. Allied has 27 locations in Virginia, including seven in the Richmond area. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wakebright.
Ain't gonna let no hatred turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let no hatred turn me around. Gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom.
This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on 97.3 WRIR, Richmond's independent radio.
This week's legal term of the week is consumer credit counseling. A consumer credit counseling agency usually offers three services. The first is budget counseling to help you pay your debts on your own. They also offer a debt management or debt repayment plan and referrals to other agencies. Under a debt management plan, the agency arranges lower payments with your creditors, usually your credit cards. You make one monthly payment to the agency, and the agency pays your creditors. But be cautious. Unless your debt management plan covers all your creditors, is affordable, and lasts no more than 4 years, it's not likely to work. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and that's this week's legal term of the week.
honored by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential Americans of the 20th century, and recently as one of the 100 most influential figures in American history by The Atlantic, consumer advocate Ralph Nader has devoted his life to giving ordinary people the tools they need to defend themselves against corporate negligence and government indifference. WRIR Community Radio volunteer Patricia Stansberry caught up with Ralph Nader following his appearance in Richmond last month and contributes this interview to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show.
I had a couple of things I wanted to address with you since we have a few minutes. Besides the 1967 Freedom of Information Act and the 1970 Clean Air Act, you lobbied for the 1967 Wholesome Meat Act, which called for federal inspections of beef and poultry and imposed standards on slaughterhouses. These are things I remember from my youth. Today, the slaughterhouses and feedlots are still pretty grim, and our food supply is in danger because of the agribusiness practices from seed ownership and poisonous chemical use to unhealthy chicken, pork, beef, and fish production. What could you do to improve the lot of family farms and the small businesses that support them?
Well, all these health and safety laws dealing with food that we got passed in Congress in the 60s and early 70s, they were subject to attrition in following years. That is, they didn't appropriate enough money for enforcement, for inspectors of poultry and beef processing plants. And that's a good lesson, because when you get laws through, the corporate lobbyists try to undermine them, weaken them, strip them of adequate budgets, put people in charge who come from their own industries in the Department of Agriculture. One result of that is that our farm policy has been very favorably disposed to big agribusiness and big factory farms and not small family farms. And historically, the greatest productivity has come from small family farms, and we have to come back to that. If we're going to use tax dollars and public policy to help our agrarian regions in the country, and I believe they do need to be preserved, Then we have to organize city folk as well as farmers beyond farmer markets, direct marketing, but in the direction of breaking up the oligopolies that supply farmers with fertilizer, for example, and pesticides, or that buy from farmers the big chain stores, for example, the supermarkets. There's a group I started called Organization for Competitive Markets, OCM, mm-hmm. and it's got a website, and you'll see what the policy is. They came close in the new ag bill, in the Senate, they actually got it passed to strengthen the laws to break up the big corporations and their anti-competitive practices dealing with farmers, but I'm not sure they got it through the House. But they're getting closer every year.
Yes, very important for all the citizens to participate as the Farm Bill develops. Mm-hmm. That another thing I was interested in hearing your take on that working within the system sometimes can be a more effective way of accomplishing change than beating on the walls from outside. If you could pick a cabinet office where you could best serve the nation and accomplish the work that you see would be of greatest benefit to the nation, what cabinet office would you take?
Well, first of all, it's not incompatible. We need good people on the inside in government. We need strong citizen groups on the outside.
Yes.
One doesn't work very well without the other. Mm-hmm. And so it depends on people's where they are in their careers, what their temperament is, whether they want to work inside government agencies or they want to develop the civic infrastructure of our democracy. I suppose the Justice Department would be a good one.
Mm-hmm. And how would that work for you?
Well, that's the department supposed to enforce the law and obey the Constitution and protect people's civil liberties and civil rights. So it's if it's properly run, it will facilitate a much higher level of democratic activity, mm-hmm. as well as keep us out of wars, because the Justice Department is supposed to be the caretaker of the Constitution, and wars should not be initiated illegally and unconstitutionally.
Thank you for that. I was really struggling with what you might come up with for an answer on that, because they're all so compartmentalized, but the Justice Department is where mm-hmm. I'd like to see you now that you mention mm-hmm. it. There's a lot of talk about faith-based community service now, about having the churches and faith-based organizations provide community services. And the debate is on whether the government should be involved in that, even among the churches. What do you think about having the religious organizations or the faith-based organizations?
Well, I think the constitutional separation between church and state, which was designed by our founding fathers to protect freedom of religion, has been blurred in recent years. Mm-hmm. And I think taxpayer dollars should not be used for religious institutional activities in the social sphere unless there's a real separation there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could have a social welfare organization that may call itself Methodist, for example, but it's not related to a church. And so that's the criteria. I think once you start getting into direct taxpayer subsidies of religious institutions, you start violating that separation of church and state. And you also get some pretty messy doctrinal disputes, like what is the church and what is the religion. And I think the founding fathers had it right.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, Ralph Nader.
If you're just joining us, this is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on 97.3 WRIR-FM, Richmond Independent Radio. And we're here in the offices of John Cole Gale in Richmond, Virginia. And we're going to be talking to John about the motor vehicle lemon law. Welcome to the show, John. Thanks for being here.
Marty, I'm thrilled to be here. And the firm is the Consumer Law Group.
Thank you so much, John. Let's start with the obvious question. What is the motor vehicle lemon law? How did it come to be?
The official name of it is called the Motor Vehicle Warranty Enforcement Act. It's commonly become known as the lemon law. It is a law that originally was started in Connecticut by a man named Mr. Woodcock. And then Virginia copied the Connecticut version to some degree back in the early 80s. And then in about 1988, when I was trying to get involved in this area, I wrote an article about how terrible our Virginia lemon law was. The the representative in Virginia that had passed the law, Alan Diamondstein, called me up, asked me to rewrite it in the way that I thought was best, because the article did mention a number of terrible flaws in our original law. Myself and a lawyer from Charlottesville went to every law in the country that was similar and other laws that were actual lemon laws, and picked the best features of all of them and put them in a model. And then we went to Alan Diamondstein, who was one of the lead Democratic representatives in the House of House of Delegates. We got the thing passed in 88. It's been amended a couple of times since then. But I think Virginia's got one of the strongest lemon laws in the country.
I've heard that said as well, John. So tell us, what vehicles are covered under Virginia's lemon law? And what about new vehicles versus used vehicles? Does the law make a distinction there?
Good question. It does in certain respects. The law definitely covers new vehicles. It covers some used vehicles, and by that I mean the used vehicles that it would cover would be those that still have the remainder of the factory warranty, but that factory warranty can be no older than 18 months from the date it first went into effect with the first owner.
So if someone buys a used vehicle, they might still have lemon law rights. They shouldn't necessarily assume they don't.
Correct. What they would want to do is check and see when the warranty first went into effect with the original owner. And if 18 months from that date has not transpired, then they can use the lemon law.
Now, you've always mentioned the word warranty in here. And would you tell our listeners what we mean by a warranty and when a warranty problem would escalate into a possible lemon law violation?
Well, the word warranty is used in a general term because the problem in the 80s and the 70s was that manufacturers were using or selling vehicles with a warranty called a limited warranty, and most of your listeners are going to think about it. They did get a limited warranty with their car. It's limited because the warrantor, meaning the manufacturer, has said that you have limited remedies, meaning their remedy is either we will repair or replace the vehicle. Period. That's it. So they've limited your remedies. They didn't say that you could take them to court and they would agree to give you your money back. So we passed this law, which increases your remedies in that if a problem occurs in your car, that's a significant one, that they attempt to fix under the warranty but are unable to within a reasonable period of time, then you are entitled to all of your money back. That means title, taxes, tags, interest on your loan, and even mandatory expert fees and attorney's fees.
So when a person has a warranty problem, what's the first thing that they should do?
Well, take it to your dealer. Most people are not thinking lawsuits when they buy a car. They're, even after the first couple repair attempts, they're not thinking lawsuits. So when the dealership says, hey, we don't have your repair order ready, we'll mail it to you, or we don't have it, or we couldn't find anything wrong, so you don't get one, a lot of people will walk away thinking, well, I don't need it anyway. But the problem comes when you decide, hey, this vehicle's a lemon and I want my money back, and your lawyer says, where are your repair orders? And you go, well, I don't have any because they never gave me any. Then you have to go back to the dealer and the dealer can't find it. Or if you go back to the dealer and the repair order isn't accurate because it doesn't list all the problems you complained of, or the dates on it are incorrect, and those dates can be important, then you got a problem.
So your advice would clearly be get your repair order each and every time you take the vehicle in, make sure it's dated, make sure it lists everything, and basically don't leave the shop without it.
Do not leave the shop without it. Make sure you go over it. Everybody's in a hurry. Everybody's busy these days. Look at your repair order. The dates are important because under the lemon law, if the vehicle's been in the shop 30 or more days over the within the 18 months, adding up all the different repair attempts, it's a lemon. And the new tactic of many manufacturers is to instruct their dealerships, I believe, to not give you the correct days. If the car has been in there 5 days, you'll look on your repair one, it's only been in there 3. And then that becomes a legal record. So you need to be careful to make sure the dates are correct, that it's in there the exact number of days that they told you it was, and make them change it before you leave.
And do Saturday and Sunday also count as days?
Yes, they do. Calendar days count. And the second thing is make sure all the problems you complained of are on there, because the lemon law says that if the vehicle's been in the shop one time for a life-threatening defect, or 3 times for a significant defect, and those problems have not been corrected, then you're entitled to a refund of your money. But if those problems aren't listed on the repair order because you walked out of there because the dealership said, hey, we couldn't find anything wrong with that problem, so we didn't put it down, then you have no proof you really complained of it.
So if within the first 18 months the vehicle's been in the shop for 30 or more days, or they've made one attempt to fix a really major, major problem.
Life-threatening. Right.
And they couldn't fix it. Or 3 significant problems and couldn't fix it. Does all that mean the vehicle is a, quote, lemon?
It does. That doesn't mean you get your money back right there, because what you have to do after that, or maybe in between that, at some point in that process, you have to write a letter, not an email, not a phone call, not a fax, but write a letter certified to the manufacturer telling them what's wrong with the car and that you want this problem corrected. The address is in the back of your warranty manual, or you can go to my website, which is www.theconsumerlawgroup.com, and there's an example of a letter there. It's very simple. You just tell them all your problems, tell them you want it fixed. You send it certified mail. They have 15 days from the date they received your letter, which you will know because that date is on the little green card the mailing company, the Postal Service, brings back to you. And if they haven't fixed it within 15 days and the problem still exists, then you've got a right to a full refund.
So certified mail, return receipt requested, to the manufacturer, not to the local dealer who sold you the vehicle, but to the manufacturer.
That's correct.
All right, and let's assume that the 15 days have run since they received your letter and nothing's been done to your satisfaction. What's the next step? Do you have to go to some sort of arbitration with the manufacturer? Can you go to court? Do you have a choice? What happens next?
My advice is to contact the dealer and the manufacturer and say, you've not complied with your warranty, you haven't fixed this vehicle, you violated the lemon law, and now I want my money back. And when they refuse, then you have a right to bring a lawsuit against them under the lemon law. There is no requirement under the lemon law to arbitrate this matter. One of the new tactics of many car dealerships and manufacturers these days is to put in your buyer's order or in the contracts you purchase a requirement that you give up your right to a jury trial, that you give up your constitutional right to go to court, and that you agree to arbitrate the matter. That may be true in lawsuits against the dealer, but the lemon law is a lawsuit against the manufacturer, and the legislature has made it clear that any arbitration agreement is not enforceable against the manufacturer and that you can go to court over it.
So you file the lawsuit. Would this be in federal court? Would this be in state court? And what happens after you file the lawsuit?
Since you're going against an out-of-state manufacturer, you are allowed to go into federal court if you want to. I think if the amount in controversy exceeds $75,000, I think that's federal court. Almost all the cases I filed and most people file are in state court because all the manufacturers are here and doing business here, and the state law allows us to sue them here. So that's what we do. We go in state court, and it can be a time-consuming process if the manufacturer decides to stonewall us, and if they decide to settle early, sometimes you can get your money back in a couple of months.
And is this a case where you would need an expert, or is this a case where the papers pretty much speak for themselves? I mean, assuming the consumer has kept accurate repair orders and they can show more than 30 days or reattempt, are these cases where you need an expert, or is these cases pretty much decided on the paperwork?
I don't believe the Supreme Court, as a matter of fact, said that experts are not a requirement as long as the manufacturer has attempted to repair this under its warranty. But experts are obviously very helpful, and depending on the case, there are people who call me up with squeaky glove compartment doors. That's not really that significant. There are people who call me up with intermittent problems. It happens sometimes, sometimes it doesn't. Then there are people who call me with consistent problems where the vehicle hesitates and stops in the middle of the road. Now, I don't think that last one would require an expert to prove that the vehicle is significantly impaired. However, some of the more questionable ones would require a mechanical expert or a value expert. That means like an appraiser, someone who would ride in the car and feel the problem and say, well, if you would try to sell this vehicle with this problem, you would bring $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 less because of this problem. Because what you have to prove, the jury has to believe that the vehicle that you have has a problem which is significantly impaired either in its use or its market value, or its safety.
And at the end of all this, what remedies are available? What can a successful litigant expect at the end?
Well, if you've got your one unsuccessful safety-related defect or three significant unsuccessful repair orders, by that I mean significant problems that were unsuccessfully repaired, or if it's been in the shop for 30 more days, adding up all the different repair attempts, and you still have a problem, then you would be entitled to a full refund, which means the cash, the sticker price of the car, title, taxes, tags, any accessories you've put on the car, attorney's fees, any expert witness fees, court costs. You would have to give the manufacturer credit for the miles you've driven up to the first repair order in which you were complaining of the problem that you're complaining of. There may be a number of problems, but there's only one big one, and so that would be the first repair order up to that date, which would be when you would have to give them credit for the mileage at the current rate of now about 24 and a half cents a mile. If you're curious, that's one-half the business deduction rate that the IRS allows a business to deduct on their taxes.
Well, thank you, John. That was very helpful. We have been talking with John Colgale at the Consumer Law Group in Richmond, Virginia. And more information about this, of course, is available at the website www.theconsumerlawgroup.com. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show.
This week's top three tips are about bank account garnishment. The first tip is to not mix your money with someone else's money in the same account. If you do this, the money legally belongs to the account holder and not the person who put it there. The second tip is to not mix your exempt money with your non-exempt money. Pensions, government benefits, and wages after taxes less than $262 per week are exempt from garnishment and shouldn't be mixed with other money. The third tip is to get legal help right away if your bank account is garnished. If you don't claim an exemption in time, you lose your money forever. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and for this week, that's our top three tips.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. The show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m., and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. Also, if you have a question you would like answered or any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. Please include your name and phone number. You also can leave that same information before 8 a.m. or after 6 p.m. by calling 200-6045. Almost 200,000 workers are hurt on the job every year in Virginia, but only a quarter of them will get some form of workers' compensation. What's compensable, what's not, and how do you get benefits if you're entitled to them? Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when our guest, private attorney John Oakey, enlightens us about your rights and your employer's responsibilities if you get injured on your job. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Winfrey.